This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hey, this is John. Sorry, I took a long time to get this one edited. I had build conference and a bunch of travel and stuff, and I just couldn't seem to get it done. Fortunately, not much changed since we recorded this, except one big thing, is the name is no longer JewelBots, it's now JewelBots. So that's JewelBots. So the site is JewelBots.com. And also, one cool new thing is that the choir campaign is launched. So that's choir, QUIRE.com/C/JewelBots. And that gives you an opportunity to actually invest in JewelBots. Cool. Okay, here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Herding Code, being recorded on April 9th, 2015. Today's guests are Sarah Chips and George Stocker. They're going to talk to us about JewelBots. You guys want to take a minute to introduce yourselves?
Sure. First of all, hi, everyone. Thanks for having us on Herding Code. Long-time listener, first-time caller. So actually, that's not true. This is like my second time. So my name is Sarah. I've been a software developer for 13 years now. My focus for the past 5 years, 6 years has been JavaScript. And about 2 years ago, I fell in love with hardware. And I left my role as a startup CTO to start following it full-time with JewelBots.
My name is George Stocker. I work on JewelBots full-time on the software side of things. I got into software pretty late, got into it around college, and then went on active duty, and then did some software there, and have been programming ever since. So I've been programming now about 10, 11 years, and I've bounced around from industry to industry, but was excited when Sarah sent out the all call for JewelBots and was able to join her writing the software for this.
So JewelBots, your tagline is smart jewelry for a smarter generation. What's it all about?
Yeah, so JewelBots are programmable wearables aimed at teenage girls. So we're building friendship bracelets that help them learn how to code.
Learn how to code. So it's not just something like a Fitbit, you know, track my number of steps.
Yeah, well, one thing we found talking to teenage girls is that they could not possibly care less about how many steps they take during the day. In fact, a lot of them actually have the fitness trackers, but because they're cool and not because they're a point of reference, which I thought was funny.
So this is going to be something that they can program?
Yeah, so out of the box, it has the functionality to function as a way for them to communicate when they're in class or playing sports together or whenever they're near each other, as well as show off who their friends and their friend groups are, kind of like a regular friendship bracelet. And then they're actually open source, so they can program them using the Arduino IDE.
Okay.
So they can make them do whatever they can imagine, like let them know if they have a new Instagram follower or tell them when their mom's on their way and whatever they can imagine.
So do you put together sort of a tutorial for them to walk them through, you know, if you want to know when your mom's on your way, here's what you have to do?
Yeah, so we're going to be including code snippets on our website for them to work with. So they'll be able to just copy paste everything that we provide for them, as well as share things with each other that they build. The logic behind that being we all kind of started copy pasting. And then you change a variable or two, and you learn what that does, and then you're on your way.
Neat. Are you going to have like a repository set up for people to share these?
Yeah, the goal is to really kind of have everything on GitHub and to make an easy way to expose that through the site, but to just have kind of as much as we can open on GitHub and to have, you know, this is how you do different things, because source control is so important to our time, but, you know, it's something that we don't learn until we got into it professionally. So maybe even exposing kids to it younger may help.
Yeah, just looking through github.com/JewelBot. So you have a couple of repositories up here. It looks like you might have some services set up. Are there some APIs that you can call?
So right now, what you're seeing on there is Arduino code for different things we've built, as well as, I believe, our website's open source, but there's only an email field in it. Now, actually, that won't be true when this airs.
When this airs, you'll actually be able to see our website on GitHub and even contribute things to it if you'd like.
Yeah, pull request welcome.
Okay, cool. How did you decide on this particular platform or combination of technology?
Yeah, so what we did is we were kind of inspired by the Minecraft generation, watching kids teaching themselves Java, you know, which is a painful language in general, and, you know, setting up their own servers, and they're like 10 years old, and they're building these mods for Minecraft in Java just because they want to make their environment cooler with their friends. So, and seeing stuff like that and seeing that happen in the past, you know, we just wanted to pique the curiosity of girls. So we ended up talking to over 100 of them to figure out what was exciting to them. We had our own theories in the beginning, which turned out to be horribly wrong. And just kind of talking to them and hearing the things that were important to them is where we came up with the functionality.
So what was horribly wrong about your original assumptions?
So my original assumption was that they would want jewelry that they could change the color of and have it be like a different color to match their outfits.
And that's what your video on Vimeo kind of looks like, isn't it?
Yeah. And that was the original concept, and we thought they'd be super into it. They definitely got excited when they saw jewelry. So that was the exciting part for them. But just having it change color wasn't that exciting for them.
Okay. So then there's other, like, you talked about, like, notification your mom's on the way or whatever. What other things other than lighting up with colors, what else am I going to expect out of it?
Yeah, so one thing that's huge to girls in high school and middle school is this tribal mentality. And this is, you know, how they identify themselves by their friends and friend groups. It's like, it's huge for them. And it's so funny because adults very rarely understand our motivation when we talk about this functionality, unless they have daughters, in which case they're like, oh yes, that makes total sense. But what we heard from the girls is their friends and their friendships are just top priority for them. So the way JulieBots work out of the box is you configure them to react to your friends so that you match your friends when they're nearby. So when you're with several different friend groups, your bracelet will be several different colors to match the different girls that you're in class with or at the mall with that are your friends. Just like regular friendship bracelets, but adding the smart component.
Will it tell the girls when that one girl said that one thing that one time to their friend? Because this is very important to my girls.
Yeah, well, then they should, we'll point them to GitHub. Maybe they can write that.
Well, I don't know. Can you kick your friend out of the group, like change their colors if they pissed you off?
Yeah.
So this sounds like fairly sophisticated stuff. Like what is the programming environment like for the girls? Like what do they actually have to do from a code perspective?
So it's just like coding an Arduino. So there will be the Arduino library living on the bracelet. So anything that you can write, any Arduino libraries, anything you can write for an Arduino is what you'll write for JulieBot. And there are lots of tutorials and libraries online of things they can do and stuff like that. So they'll have access to a Bluetooth module, a microprocessor, the button and LEDs, and a motor. So they can manipulate them to do anything they like.
And the goal is to also have the kind of the predefined interactions also available through the API so that they can see how we programmed them and, you know, modify those as necessary.
Is it Bluetooth that you use to detect nearby friends?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a mesh network of Bluetooth. So they actually don't need to have their phones with them or anything like that, which is how it works. And that's actually technology that we've patented. Something that we've decided to go towards working with these girls first, but in the future, this can be used for all sorts of different reasons.
So my question was related to the Bluetooth, and I'm hoping that one of you two is smart enough to explain this to me. How is something RFID. So why would you use Bluetooth over something like RFID, or is that just not powerful enough, or is it just because RFID isn't really consumer oriented? Like Arduino doesn't come with an RFID connector. Maybe it does. I don't know anymore. I'm so old and out of it.
So RFID is the distance that you get with RFID is really only a few inches and doesn't have the range that Bluetooth does. So Bluetooth gets us 30 to 50 feet of range, and even NFC also doesn't have that much range. So it's more of a range issue than anything else.
And then, you know, one of the things with Arduino is that, you know, there's like, you can plug other stuff into it. I'm assuming this is like, you know, it's enclosed. There's not really, I'm not expecting to, extend hardware or add on other hardware, right?
So the hardware itself, no. The hardware itself, you can't really build on. It's encased in charms, and the design is more to be open software.
Cool. But I guess potentially, I could, since it is interacting via Bluetooth, then there's room for that kind of, like they can connect to each other, but you could also potentially do something where, I don't know, they can connect to other Bluetooth stuff maybe.
Oh yeah, definitely. You could definitely make it so when you walk in your when you walk in your house, all your smart lights turn on.
Oh, now I need one.
for the girls when they sneak out at night, you want the lights to turn on when they come back in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what we're afraid of, is these like crafty dads.
This is a father's dream.
And that's also
put a GPS LoJack on there, and I'm in. I'm in.
One thing about the hardware itself is that these charms are interchangeable. So the actual hardware is in a small disc that you could put in anything. So we're wondering if actual adults will be super into buying them and printing their own cases. I think that might be a market we might discover.
I really want a Triforce one.
Yes.
That's great.
So we could write a virus then, huh?
Just
for it.
Like a literal virus?
Communicate over Bluetooth. Well, actually, yeah, I guess you could. You could put like the little bit of a flu vaccine in a little Julie bot and just have a little needle, right? And then when it gets a certain Bluetooth signal, it just pricks them and injects a little bit.
I decided to leave needles out, and that's part of the design process.
I might be on a watch list now. I'm not sure.
Still.
So, what was the hardest part of that design process? Was it selecting a development environment or sourcing the hardware?
I think everything is the answer to that. Yeah. one thing that's interesting about hardware, in software you can do pretty much anything. And people are going to get mad at this, but you can do basically anything in 6 to 8 weeks using software. Like, you can anything that, you know, like at least an MVP, but in hardware, that is not the case. In hardware, you can do pretty much anything in 6 to 9 months to years. So that's been really the hardest part of the design process, is learning that. And the decisions you make, like there's how much they affect and how much they affect your timeline and things like that. Like you can't, once you've decided something, going back and changing it is next to impossible. It's been really interesting.
So, you know, one thing that always comes up with wearables is power. Like, number one, how do you get power into it? And number two, what are you kind of hoping for battery life?
So for us, Julie Bots will be shipping with a bracelet stand that the girls can put their bracelet on at night that will plug in via USB to either a wall or their computer. And for battery life, it really depends on interaction. Our goals are to give them a couple days. We need to user test, which we haven't yet, to see how much of a battery drain the different interactions are. Also, how often are they happening? One thing that we need to figure out is, what if we have a super popular girl and her Julie Bot's just on all the time? People are messaging her all the time. Like, what does that charge look like? So there's definitely a lot we still need to learn.
That will be good, because it will automatically lower her popularity when she has to carry around like a marine battery with her goes.
That's how we'll solve popularity. That's a great idea.
So I was just typing in the chat. I thought maybe a kinetic charger. Like, you guys remember the old Seiko watches where when you walk, it kind of winds it or charges it up. The kinetic motion in there causes it to charge.
Yeah.
Something like that would be interesting. I don't know what the size limitations are, but hey, it fit in a watch, right? that's just, I don't know. You can take that and you can buy me a beer if you use it and sell a million.
Okay, great.
So looking at the new health app on the iPhone and things like that, would it be possible to add in things like pulse monitors, things like that? Not really. No.
Not in the current iteration, just because it requires sensors that we don't have. And like that stuff we could throw in if we wanted to, but because of size and cost constraints, we decided to leave out things like an accelerometer or any type of sensors that might allow you to do that.
Oh, this was my actual question I had, along with the kinetic thing. So manufacturing, are you printing these yourselves, or do you have like a sweatshop in Jersey or something, or because I'm thinking about this, I'm like, okay, so they like 3D printing these things off, and then I have this vision of Sarah and they're soldering everything together.
Yeah, like hand lovingly soldered in New Jersey.
Selling point, right?
It's artisanal programmable jewelry.
Made the old way.
Yeah. So we are going to be doing large-scale manufacturing. We're currently working through a partnership with PCH, who we're hoping to work with. It's the parent company of an accelerator we did called Highway One. We toured their manufacturing facilities in China a few months ago when we went there. It was pretty awesome. So right now, for our prototype versions, we have been working with local factories for small runs. And there are places in San Francisco that we've worked with that do fairly economical small runs, but we will be manufacturing overseas.
So what's all the hardware you've got on board then? Obviously, you got like a motherboard, you got, battery, you've got the Bluetooth stuff, and then the output with lights. What other sort of hardware are you using?
Yeah, so we have a microprocessor/Bluetooth that's 4 millimeters by 4 millimeters. So that's wild.
Wow, that's tiny.
Isn't that tiny? I always say you could like accidentally eat it and you'd never know. So we've got that. We've got a motor to send vibration notifications, 4 LEDs, and a button and a battery.
What is the button for? Is that like on off, or is it controlling, like dismissing notifications, or?
The button is for a lot of things. Do you want to?
Yeah. So the button itself, when we were thinking about this, there's really only two things you could do. You can have it light up or you can have it buzz. And when you think about buzzing, the first thing you think of is Morse code. So if you have a buzzer or you have a button and doing so will send buzzes, then you could conceivably send Morse code messages or those style messages to your friends. And that's the initial thought of what the button will allow you to do. A lot of program messages to your friends in the form of Morse code.
Wow.
Oh, Morse code's going to make a comeback here.
Exactly.
John, your skills from the Navy.
This is the new way to send messages in class, right?
Yeah. Morse code is great. Also, if they come up with their own codes, like I'll send you 3 buzzes when the cute guy is outside the door, that kind of thing. We've talked to a lot of girls, and they come up with their own languages constantly, or they use existing ones. We talked to a few girls who last summer taught themselves American Sign Language so they can communicate around adults without adults understanding what they're saying. So,
as a father of 2 girls, I'm really shocked and scared about what I'm going to be getting into when they get older.
What are you expecting these will cost?
We're aiming for under $100. And our goal is to get as close to $60 as we can. It really depends on a lot of different things, which is why we can't really commit to it now. It depends on how much manufacturing costs us. It depends, if we have any big design changes between now and release, then that'll definitely change how much things cost. But our goal is to keep the price cost as low as possible so that it's accessible for everyone. And the way we think about like the $60 price point is it's the price of a video game. So that's definitely a cost that they're used to spending.
That sounds totally reasonable. For all that you can do with it, and like you're saying, the fun you have with your friends if they've got them and all that. I mean, that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
So here's another idea for the thing. You set up something where you can tag their backpack and then when they get closer and farther away, kind of like that old hot and cold game, it either buzzes or flashes more the closer they get to it. So my girls can find their backpacks when I ask them where they are.
That's a great idea. I like that idea a lot.
It would be like the expensive version of the tile app.
Yeah.
So from one thing about starting a software company is you can effectively do it for zero cost these days. I'm assuming hardware is a little bit more capital intensive. I'd be interested in hearing about, how do you get started with this kind of thing? Do you have to immediately go out and get funding? How much can you do before you have to start thinking about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's pretty serious. For us, it's been a long road. Our initial funding came from, past me, was a hardware accelerator called Highway One. And that allowed me to focus on JulieBots full time. And I'd been working on it as a side project for about a year at that point. And so we've also raised venture capital as well as angel funding. And that helps us where we are now. And yeah, the truth is hardware companies are a lot more expensive to start just because you need resources and you need physical hardware to build, and prototyping and different things like that. So they're definitely a little more costly.
This sounds like something that, you'd see floating around on Kickstarter. Is that something you'd consider doing?
Yeah, actually, we're projected to do a Kickstarter sometime over the next couple months.
Cool.
Right now, we're focused on getting one thing we want to do before our Kickstarter is figure out exactly how much JulieBots are going to cost so that we can sell JulieBots through our Kickstarter.
My one bit, and we've talked and groused a bit about Kickstarter over the years, my one bit of feedback is keep communicating. It's the most frustrating thing in the world when you're like backing something and you're excited about it and then the communication dies off. That's like the one thing. It's like, let me know if there's problems, but just let me know because it's so bad when things kind of go dark.
Yeah, I think I spent like $300 or something like that on some VR goggles like 3 years ago that I still have never seen. I don't even know if that's ever going to happen.
The worst one I got was something actually shipped. It's hardware. It's sitting on my desk right next to me, and they never shipped the drivers for it. And then they're like, oh, the drivers are coming along. And then it's like just never got the drivers.
That's really bad.
So as a tangent, I've actually had really good success with Kickstarter, but I have mostly backed like board games and things like that, which are similar to kind of a hardware project, right? Because you've got, we got to do, production, design, and all this kind of stuff, shipping and all that. And one of the things that I've found is that the companies that have all of those pipelines already built, like, okay, we already know who we're going to use for production. We've already, figured out how much it's going to cost to produce each one of these units. Kind of like what you're talking about, how much it's going to cost to sell these things. Have had much more success than the people who are like, I have a dream. I want to publish this thing. And then they get in there and they're hit like, oh no, I can't survive on the $10,000, that I raised over my Kickstarter. It's going to cost $50,000 to produce this thing and ship it to all my backers. So definitely that's the one thing I've learned is the people that have that stuff already figured out ahead of their Kickstarter are much more successful and their backers end up much happier than the ones who don't.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. So one thing I've heard as a warning for potential Kickstarters, especially when it comes to physical products, is to have a really good handle on what your cost is and your manufacturing pipeline and things like that beforehand if you're going to sell through Kickstarter. Because otherwise, surprises happen all the time where all of a sudden it costs double what you thought it would to manufacture, and you've sold all these units and you've sold them for the exact same price it's going to cost you to manufacture. So now you're in a situation where, you're volunteering your time to build things for people. It's not great.
So back on the programming stuff for a second. So I've never done any Arduino development, but you mentioned there's this Arduino IDE that they would use to do this kind of stuff. Are there concerns that like that's too much, that's a little too low level for some people, and you guys have like a vision of making sort of a, you know, a more user-friendly or like higher abstraction kind of product to let people play around with the stuff without diving down to that level?
Yeah, that may, who knows, someone may build that. That may come out of it. So we don't think we're going to convert every young girl into a coder because, yeah, coding is hard and it does require a lot of commitment. But we think that we're going to enable a lot of them to look at code in a way that they hadn't before. One thing that we've done is we've gone to a lot of high schools, and what we learned early on is calling it coding was really bad, because as soon as a girl came over, they would see jewelry and they would be really excited. And we'd be like, hey, do you want to code this jewelry? And they would throw their hands up and they'd be like, oh no, I'm sorry, that's not my thing. You know, I don't do that. It was like a way to shut them down right away. And so what we're trying to do here is just make a world where they see that as something for them. You know, the opposite of maker is not girly. The girly and maker can live in the same place. Just because you like things that are more feminine doesn't mean that you're not technical. So what we want to do is kind of open their minds to the idea of coding, understand it's something that's accessible for them, and show them other girls that are doing it as well, and also give them a really cool product that they love. So if we can convert a percentage of JewelryBots users to coders and make the rest of them just more comfortable with the idea of coding and engineering, I think that's we've accomplished our goal. So to answer your question, Arduino coding is difficult. There is an awesome girl named Super Awesome Sylvia. If you guys haven't seen her, you need to find her. I'm not sure how old she is. She's definitely, I don't want to offend her by saying she's 13 if she's not. I think she's awesome. But she is an avid Arduino coder, and she has a book about it. And there are a lot of girls that age that do find it, you know, through whatever means that they have. So but it's C++, and C++ is difficult. So it's really, we'll see who we convert and who we don't. But as long as we make everyone more comfortable, I think we've hit our goal.
So Sarah, you said a couple years ago you became interested in hardware hacking. You know, I think for a lot of software people like me, you know, like, you know, I think like when a non-programmer thinks about coding, they think about it as like a kind of magic that they're not capable of doing. And I think some software people think of hardware as magic that's like a level below what they're capable of doing. And I'd be interested in like how you made that transition from software to hardware and what, you know, what was that like?
Yeah. So I went to a conference in Dublin, Node Dublin. It was a pretty awesome conference. It was at the Guinness factory, which was really cool. And the conference was all about Node. However, there was one hardware talk that I got to see. And it was done by awesome hardware expert Emily Rose. She's still a really big part of the community. And some other people demoed some pretty cool hardware, like a drone that charged whenever it saw the color red, so you could bullfight the drone, different neat stuff like that. And that was awesome. And as kind of her finale, she had programmed this fog machine with JavaScript. And she told this whole story about how, like, she blew out all the electricity in her hotel room the night before. And, like, the wall was, like, all brown because, you know, the converter didn't work and all this stuff. And it was this whole thing. And she was like, but I think we've got it to work, so let's do it. So she turns on this fog machine that she had programmed, and it goes nuts. And it filled up the entire audience and the entire, you know, huge room. Guinness security guards were running in, being like, what are these crazy people doing? And it was total chaos. And I was like, this is so awesome. I need to learn how to do this. So I went up to her afterwards, and she gave me this big bag of LEDs, which at the time I was like, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. How do I even do this? And so I went home, and I worked with some friends who had done this before, and they showed me how to get an LED to light up, which is like hello world in hardware. And it was great. I was just addicted.
You know, I was going to comment on the hardware programming being kind of the, not necessarily the black box, but the Matterhorn kind of for software folks. Cause we're so used to, yeah, just new open new object. You know, we'll just add more RAM to the server, right? But, you know, when you're programming at the hardware level, you're not only thinking about, okay, so how many kilobytes do I have for this loop? But you're also thinking about, okay, how much power is this going to use? And yeah. is there any way I can make this use less power? And, you know, when you're writing to the pinouts and stuff, you're like, okay, I don't want to send too much because I don't want to short out whatever's attached to this pinout. And thinking at that level is I think really, really good for programmers because it gets them to not necessarily prematurely optimize, but to just think differently about how they're writing code.
Yeah. Yeah, George has kind of been thrown into this recently. I'd be interested to hear your experience focusing on hardware for the last few months or so.
Yeah, so I started out, and coming into this, I knew really nothing about hardware. I'd done a little Arduino programming, but one of the first things I had to do was meet with the people who are designing our prototype board and, you know, kind of put together all of the interactions, all the things we want the device to do, and found out real quick that the things we wanted for the device to do would drain the battery really quickly. And so then it came back to, okay, how much power are we talking about? And, you know, since we have this limited amount of time and we want the battery to last more than 3 hours, what do we do? And it came a lesson really quickly in how small little things like a haptic motor starting up or LEDs at different colors can actually throw off device usage and can, you know, drain the battery more than other types of colors. Not to mention, then you talk about messaging and, you know, Bluetooth low energy, BLE, how much it uses and how much can you use it so the device can last more than, you know, 10 minutes or so.
You know, one thing I'd asked earlier a little bit about the charging, I think, but and battery. But so you said there's a stand for it. Is it like actually, is there a plug plugging into it, or is it kind of like a wireless charging?
So the bracelet itself has 4 touch points at the bottom. You could barely see them, but those touch points line up with touch points on the charger, and that's how the charging happens on the device. It's also how code gets uploaded.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so you plug the charger right into your laptop, and that's how the code gets onto the bracelet.
Have you considered using Bluetooth to upload the code, kind of like the Pebble smartwatch does?
We have considered using Bluetooth, and the chip that we're using actually allows for Bluetooth uploading. But one thing we thought of, and a lot of these young ladies use desktops, and we didn't want to limit it to only users with laptops. So we decided to go with the wired uploading.
I'm guessing that, like you'd said, in testing, you know, that some of your assumptions were wrong and that you've refined things. Are you continuing to, like, work with, you know, some kids that you're testing these with and kind of validating things as you're going?
Yeah, I think that's the most fun part of this job is that I get to hang out with teenagers all the time. Yeah, we talk to them all the time. We check every change with them. Design-wise, they're who came up with the design. We base it a lot off of what we see them wearing now and, you know, what's important to them. We've gotten feedback on every step of the process. So it's really, we're not building for us, right? Like, we're building a jewelry for, you know, women in my demographic. I'm not going to say what that is. But I maybe touch base with our users less often because, you know, I feel like I have a good touch point on what the community wants, even though, you know, it's still very important. But we're not building for us, and no one on this team is a teenage girl, and we haven't been teenage girls in a while. So hearing from them is super important.
So where is this product in its sort of life cycle? You mentioned, you know, you're going to be doing a Kickstarter. Like, how long before you expect people to have these things in their hands or on their wrists?
We're hoping to ship by late 2015, early 2016, somewhere in that area.
And most importantly, how do my daughters get on the beta program?
Yeah, great. that'll be part of the Kickstarter, but maybe you can get an in.
It's and then
do we know anybody who, you know somebody who can maybe get you in?
I could talk to someone.
So then you're 3D printing these. Are you also kind of tweaking the, you know, like the visible design, like the actual shape of the jewelry? And are you expecting there's going to be like kind of one look of the jewelry, or are you experimenting with kind of different designs for those as well?
Yeah. How do you handle the fashion angle, I guess?
Yeah. So we're actually using injection molding for the charms. The charms are interchangeable. So JulieBots will ship with a default charm and band, but just like an Apple Watch, you can use your own bands, you can order different bands and different charms to personalize your JulieBot. That's one thing that we heard from them was super important is, you know, they're reaching an age where individuality is a priority for them. So having something that can be very theirs is important. And user testing right now, one thing we're hearing a lot is monograms. So I don't think that that's going to be in V1, but who knows?
So let me ask, is there anything specific we should touch on? Anything you wanted to talk about, George, Sarah?
I was just thinking about using the app as a way to get girls into programming. So there's the Arduino, which is kind of the hardcore mode. And then you have the app itself, which is going to provide sort of a, don't want to use any copyrighted terms, but if this, then that style programming to allow you to, you know, see visually, hey, if I do this, you know, what happens and what can I make happen? Or, you know, based on these, this notification, what can I do here? So trying to incorporate the sort of that style of programming into it to get them into it gently.
Okay. So there'll be like two different modes for programming the device.
Yeah. So you'd have the, you know, hey, I'd like to just be bare metal. And that's actually scary for me. So I don't know how it'd be for a teenage girl. But then you have the, hey, if I wanted to do something like programming through an app or, you know, just quickly doing it, showing you how that translates and, you know, how that works.
Mm-hmm. I think we had a question on Twitter. Francis Gulata wants to know what your thoughts are on Piglet.
Francis is
he's not as much fun as Pooh. But better than a rabbit.
Francis is a great friend and also an amazing hardware hacker. And he knows that I'm obsessed with pigs and I really want a pig. So one day when I leave New York and I move to the suburbs, the first thing I'm getting is a piglet.
Awesome.
So then you'll need, you know, jewelry for your pig as well.
Of course, yeah. Only the finest.
And you'll have to know when really? The pig has really? Has escaped the building, so the messaging and the notifications for the Bluetooth proximity will be useful there.
Really, all you need is a thin layer of breading and some spices and maybe applesauce on the side. And there's new potatoes, and I think you're good.
So you mentioned app, you know, coding via an app, and I'm not sure if we dug into that and I just missed it, no. But what is that kind of like a phone app, or is that kind of the idea there?
Yeah, so it would be Android and iOS compatible app, and what it would allow you to do is it both allow you to add and remove friends via the app, but also to set up how your JulieBot should react if you're around different friend groups. So, you know, hey, if you know, two of my friends are around, then do this special custom thing that I want to do, or, you know, send them both a message, or, you know, if it's 7 a.m., kind of buzz to let me know that, hey, I'm going to be late for school. Things like that. Hmm.
And then do they, so there's the kind of direct uploading by plugging it in. And then if I'm using the app, is that communicating directly from, you know, via Bluetooth, or is there kind of like some kind of central hub thing, you know, like a web thing that there's no real like Wi-Fi connectivity, huh?
Right. So it's all through Bluetooth. Okay. So if I don't have my phone around, then my JulieBot can react to other JulieBots based on whatever programming is on the device, based on whatever I've already uploaded to the device, my friends' groups or whatever. If the phone is around, then you can do all sorts of things, but you can also upload new code to your device through your phone, through this app. And all that data is stored on the device itself, and then secondarily is stored on the app, and then tertiarily, stored on a central web server so that, you know, should anything happen to your app and to your phone, we kind of have a copy of what you've tried to do.
So if I'm wearing one of these devices, I guess when I set it up or when I first buy it, I put my name into the device somehow. Is that how other people know who their device is seeing during the day? So they select, you know, from a group of names that they've seen?
Yeah. So every device would have, when you initially buy it and when you initially pair it, you say, you know, hey, this is who I am. And all Bluetooth devices kind of send out a signal of what they are. Mm-hmm. I am a trackpad. I'm an Apple Watch. I'm a JulieBot device. And so based on those two things, you can say, oh, hey, this, you know, is my friend who has come into proximity. So, but you can also do that for the bus style messaging. Then you get into more elaborate modes of communication where you want to make sure you're only sending it to the right people. And the new Bluetooth, the BLE spec 4.1 provides for that. But it's pretty new. Latter half of 2014 it came out. So all the stuff we're doing has kind of never really been done before. So we're learning as we're going, and there's really no one to copy from.
Awesome. Is there a possibility, like, I don't know, through the charger thing, to do like firmware updates? I mean, like to update the software on these as you go?
Yeah, so the Bluetooth chip we're using allows for over-the-air firmware updates. So if we need to make any big changes at JulieBot Central, we can distribute them to all JulieBot.
Wow.
One of the things that you end up dealing with, and you don't think about in a software world, it's like software as a service. You always have the latest software. But with firmware, one of the issues we have is that people could, if they wanted to, not update the firmware. And so there are things that you don't think about in a software world that happen all the time in a hardware world. Being disconnected, not wanting to update. So how do you handle that? And it's been a lot of the challenge is making sure that, you know, things still work even if someone doesn't want the firmware update.
All right, Sarah George, anything coming up that people can listen for or watch for or attend or any calls to action?
I have one last comment before the calls to action. Sure. Is one question we get from parents all the time that I need them to know is, no, we will not help you find your kids. Parents are always like, will JulieBots let me know where my daughter is? It's like, no, find out where your daughter is. They're not gonna help you. So there's that. Secondly, we have a Kickstarter coming up soon. Another opportunity we have for people to actually invest in JulieBots and be part of the company and part of the company's growth is a campaign we're coming up on the newly branded crowdfunding platform from BetaWorks. Stay tuned for news on that, and that will allow people to invest anywhere from $1 to $10,000 in JulieBots and to get a piece of JulieBots themselves and be part of our growth and part of the company.
All right. Very cool. I want to thank you both for being on the show. This is fascinating on many different levels.
Yeah. And JulieBots.com for updates, and check out our Twitter account at JulieBots, all those things.
And thank you for having us.
That too.
Yes. And I think that's a wrap. So thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Tune in again next week when Scott Kuhn says...
Is there time for an NPM rant?
All right, pause. We'll be right back.
Hey, this will give us a chance to think of smart questions.
Do 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 do. Do 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 do. Do 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 do.
So give everyone a chance to think of smart questions, except for Scott, who will just sing.
It's hold music. She didn't give us any hold music.